Well, voting access is just one of the many issues North Carolinians are talking about this campaign season. All this week, NPR is taking a look at the political mood of the country. And today, the State of Things is going to join that conversation. We're examining what political issues are most important to North Carolina voters and how the mood in our state affects political engagement. We want to hear from you as our conversation continues. Give us a call at 877-962-9862. Email us at sot@wnc.org. Are you more or less politically engaged this year than you were 2 or 4 years ago? Why the change? And what are you interested in? 877-962-9862, sot@wnc.org to join the conversation. First, I'm joined in our studio by political experts Susan Roberts, a professor of political science at Davidson College. She, in fact, joins us from WDAV. Welcome back, Susan.
Good morning. Thanks.
Also with us is Jarvis Hall, a political science professor at North Carolina Central University. Jarvis, welcome back. Good to have you on the program.
Happy to be here, Frank.
Let me start with you. How do you see the effect of these voting rights issues on voter behavior? Have we seen any effect yet?
Well, I think for some, this may be a rallying call. People may actually make sure that they vote and will make sure that others within their communities vote because they see this as a threat on their citizenship rights. We saw something to that effect in Ohio after they passed their voter ID bill. But at the same time, we see a battle against what are called voter suppression laws, the monster voter bill here in North Carolina. So it's been fought on two fronts. One is to push back on it, just as you just talked about in the legal arena. But the other one is to really make sure there's widespread knowledge about what's going on, that people know what is required with the new voter ID bill, and that people turn out in large numbers as a way to sort of show them, so to speak.
Susan, we have had one midterm election since the Shelby decision and the North Carolina legislation, and I wonder if we've seen any of that effect or if it will show up more, you know, in a greater way in a presidential election.
Great. I think that we can't really compare the turnout in a midterm election with a general election. And that goes to the point that you have more partisan supporters that come out. People don't know exactly who's on the ballot. There's not a presidential candidate that's like the Super Bowl candidate. And I think that when we look at 2008 and 2012, we've seen a drop-off. And I think that people are now, they might not pay attention to the switch in the primary date, which is now March the 15th. I think it remains to be seen whether or not this will have a disproportionate impact on, and let's face it, if you look at changes in at least the 2013 law, which cut early voting, which was disproportionately a service that African-American voters used. If you look at disallowing pre-registration of high school students with a disproportionate number of young people as identifying with the Democratic Party, it may be difficult to undo the perception that these are still in place. You have to be a pretty savvy political follower to see that these are not in place. I agree that I think there are people working on the ground. I think it's a big task to try to get everyone up to speed about exactly what they need. For example, one of my students said, well, I don't know if I can register to vote because I don't have a water bill. And it was kind of there was confusion about exactly what you did need. North Carolina has done, their website does have a lot of explicit information about what you need to do, where you need to go. And I think if you know to do that, it can really help inform the electorate. But I think it still remains to be seen how much the changes have occurred. And it depends on what you're talking about. Are you talking about integrity of the ballot, which sounds, you know, is something everyone would agree on, versus voter suppression? And I think there are two sides of the aisle, and the language is very important. Governor McCrory has been campaigning for photo ID since he was elected, and I think the Republicans are going to push that issue as far as they can.
Well, let's talk about the larger question of voter engagement beyond just this issue. Jarvis, there's an awful lot of attention. It seems to me much more, given the amount of media out there and the media attention that this primary battle has drawn to itself in this 2016 cycle. Is there more? What do we mean when we say engagement? And is there any way to measure whether or not Americans are more or less engaged in this political race?
Well, until a few days from now, no votes have been cast in this election cycle. So it's hard to say in terms of what voters do, which is casting ballots. What we have to listen to are the campaigns and see how they're doing on the ground in terms of mobilizing the people that they need to craft the electorate that helps them in terms of the composition of the electorate, more young people, if you're on the Democratic side, more people of color, if you're on the Democratic side, et cetera. It's hard to measure at this point how engaged people are, but you can look at some grassroots efforts, especially, for example, the Moral Mondays and things of that nature as evidence that we will see a groundswell of mobilization and of political activity and political education and GOTV, a get out the vote, in response to what some people see as the negative policies of the Republican legislature and Republican governor.
Well, we'll talk more about whether those efforts will translate into actual votes and more activity at the polls and other conversations as we look at voter engagement today. Susan Roberts is with me, a professor of political science at Davidson College. Jarvis Halt's a political science professor at North Carolina Central University. And we will have more and more guests and your calls at 877-962-9862 on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today we're talking about political engagement in North Carolina. Give us a call, 877-962-9862. Send us an email at sot@wunc.org. Susan Roberts is with me, a professor of political science at Davidson College. Jarvis Hall is also here, political science professor at North Carolina Central University. Joining us now is Steve Green, political science professor at North Carolina State. Welcome, Steve.
Good to be here.
Yeah, and Tom Jensen is also joining us, director of public policy polling, a national polling firm that is based in Raleigh. Welcome back, Tom.
Hey, good to be with you.
Before the break, we were talking about some voting rights and access issues, and one of the issues that we heard about from several listeners is gerrymandering. That people are upset about and think that, you know, something needs to be done. Do you have any research on that, and what does it show?
Well, we find that North Carolinians really are concerned about gerrymandering, and what's interesting about it is we found that large majorities of Democrats, Republicans, and independents in the state all support creating an independent redistricting process in North Carolina. So obviously most sort of hot button issues these days, we talk about how polarized we are. Democrats are on one side, Republicans are on the other side, that sort of thing. But this is really an exception to that, where we see people agreeing across party lines. And I think it's particularly notable. Republicans wanted independent districting when Democrats were in charge, and Republican voters still do want that. Republican politicians sort of lost interest in independent redistricting once they got in control of the state. But when you get to the actual rank and file of the party, that's something that Democrats and Republicans strongly agree about.
I think one of the things we want to talk about in this program today is what you just mentioned, sort of where we have any kind of common ground or agreement, or where voters seem to be stirred up about an issue, and whether or not that drives them to the polls or drives them away. Let's listen to Anson Birch.
My name is Anson Birch, and I'm from Durham, North Carolina. At one point, I was very politically engaged in Obama's 2008 campaign. I volunteered, did some canvassing and phone bank work for him. As time has gone on, I've become less politically involved, part of it just due from the realities of young children and my time. But a lot of it really has to do with ever since the Citizens United ruling, I just feel like the entrance of money into politics pushes out the voices of everyone else. I feel like, what's the point of the calling and the door-to-door when these dark money organizations can pour millions of dollars into a campaign, flood the airwaves with ads, and sort of have the upper hand? Money is now the currency of political communication, whereas once it was canvassing, door-to-door, voters, you know, political rallies, and I just feel like that's been pushed out. I believe that gerrymandering has become a very big problem in our system. Districts that aren't drawn well or districts that aren't representative of the people in them don't hold the politicians accountable. They don't have to listen to their constituents. They don't have to do what the people are asking for because there's absolutely zero risk that they'll be turned out in the next election.
Steve Green, let me ask you a little bit about what he's talking about here, because it seems on the one hand that if you are upset, if you're a voter who believes that this is voter suppression and it was done deliberately to take your vote away, or if you see gerrymandering as a deliberate attempt, or big money as an attempt to hush or shout you down, it seems to me that animates you and gets you to the polls. But part of what Anson is saying is it's deflated him. He's thinking, what's the point?
It's both. For some voters, it's going to make them angry and make them want to do something about it. And unfortunately, it is dispiriting and disillusioning if you look broadly at the American political context and see the absolutely huge role of big money and the obviously disproportionate influence that, you know, just, you know, a few dozen billionaires can have on our politics. It's easy to say, what's the point of going door to door and talking to people? And oh, and by the way, I should throw out the political science research says there's still very much the point in doing that. Don't be too dispirited. Don't give up. That is absolutely the best way to influence elections and to change minds is just conversations and door to door. And that is worth so much more than all that money spent on ads.
Jarvis, what is, though, at a practical level, what's the difficulty in making that sell to voters who feel utterly pushed out and that there's no hope? This is silly. It's not my system anymore.
Well, you're combating what is a cynical electorate, those who believe that things are stacked against them in favor of the rich and the privileged. But it is important to show where victories have taken place, to show how change can take place in terms of turning around elections that were thought to be going in one direction through mass mobilization, through retail politics. Just as Steve said, it's still important to be engaged in the face-to-face, on-the-ground politics. And so it is possible, but it is very, very hard. Resources have to be committed. Time, people, and money are in short supply often, especially to those who are trying to mobilize grassroots folk. And so you have to use your resources wisely. You have to mobilize external resources in some cases, you know, but it is possible to show people, to show that change can take place with grassroots, retail politics, boots on the ground. Just look at the Obama races in 2008 and 2012.
Well, one of the things that's changing very quickly nationally and certainly here in the state of North Carolina is demographics. And Tom, if we're talking about political engagement in this state, I guess it's a sort of natural to take a look at who we are as a state. What does your research show in terms of changing demographics in North Carolina?
Well, the electorate in North Carolina every year is becoming more and more racially diverse. Every single election we have has a record number of Hispanic voters participating in it. African American turnout has been at record levels over the last few election cycles. And what we're seeing as a result of that is that the white share of the electorate is going down. And that's really one of the major reasons that North Carolina has become such a competitive state in national elections, where 10, 20 years ago you would have considered it to be very reliably a red state, is that these shifts that are happening in our population are helping Democrats for the most part. The groups that are growing within the electorate are more Democratic-leaning groups. The groups that are declining within the electorate are more Republican-leaning groups. Beyond just the racial angle, you increasingly have a trend, of course, of urbanization in the South, and urban voters are a lot more likely to be Democratic than rural voters. So even though Democrats are getting a smaller and smaller share of the white vote in North Carolina, which is sort of making it harder for them to win some of the state legislative races they used to win in more rural parts of the state and that sort of thing, you also have these changes making it so that North Carolina isn't a state in the presidential race anymore that all the candidates can just ignore.
Well, Susan, you refer to North Carolina not as a swing state, but a battleground state. Why?
Well, I don't think you can say that, at least in the last 20 or so years, that it's really been a state that goes back and forth. It was a battleground state in 2008 because it was very contested. And I think that Tom has once said, and talked to Davidson, came and talked to my students once, about North Carolina as being a purple state. I think I'd also add to what Tom said about the changing demographics, and this you don't need a number to really get a reference, but a study out of UNC Chapel Hill said in 2012 that just about 45% of North Carolinians were born outside of North Carolina. The reason I say you don't need a number there, you can just talk to other parents at the soccer field. You can talk to people, your coworkers. You can look at the folks that are going to the PTA meetings. And I think that has an influence. It reinforces the urban vote, and it also gives you a more better educated group of voters because they're twice as likely to have a BA or move here. It's also a big retirement community. So some of that is very volatile. I think also I'd point out that the forms of political participation, they are still dependent on the grassroots, but we've gotten much more savvy, candidates have, at this micro-targeting different cohorts to kind of animate them and get them to the polls. When we talk about political participation, it's not just voting and turnout and running for office. I think now we look at things such as where we get our news, and where you get your news and how much news you get can influence how you want to get out. And I'm still looking at the evolution of Twitter as something that is changing the face of participation, and it may bring more young people to the polls or less. Political scientists don't often agree about whether you vote for someone or against someone. But this dark money, as we've been talking about, it may not be always successful in the outcome of an election, but it is very successful in increasing the negativity that we saw in the Tillis Hagen race, in which most expensive Senate race in the country. And I think that has a lingering taste in the mouth of a voter in North Carolina.
But, Steve, how does this play out in a state like North Carolina, again, where you have in the last cycle, or it was in 2012, where we saw a majority of the state's voters who are voting for national seats voted Democratic, but because of the way the seats were configured, the majority went to the Republicans in terms of the congressional delegation. When you look at the statewide races, like the governor's race and the presidential race here, do they tend to map pretty in a pretty similar way?
Pretty closely. As I like to say, there's no way to gerrymander a whole state. So, that's, Pat McCrory's big challenge. And the Democrats' optimism for 2016 is based on the fact that in presidential election years, you tend to get a more diverse electorate, which helps Democrats, and you tend to get a younger electorate, which tends to help Democrats. And so, in the statewide races, where we're looking at every reason to believe these should all be some very competitive races. And then you look at non-statewide races, and you see that the Republicans have executed one of the most successful gerrymanders in the country, and we really shouldn't expect much to change there.
Tom Jensen at Public Policy Polling. Is there any way to tell what the impact is of social media in terms of generating actual voter interest and people turning up at the polls?
Well, I think it's a really interesting. I think we're going to get a great test case of that in Iowa next week, because I think that, for instance, in the Democratic presidential race, Bernie Sanders has used social media and more innovative ways than political candidates usually do. He's straight up said in some of his social media campaigns, people say young people don't vote, so prove them wrong on my behalf. And it'll be interesting to see in a race that is very close in Iowa next week whether, for instance, Bernie Sanders is able to use social media as a key ingredient in bringing a lot of people out to the polls who don't have a history of voting before. One thing that's been really interesting in both the Iowa and New Hampshire polls when thinking about this presidential race is that people who voted in 2008, 2012 are very strongly for Hillary Clinton. If it was just people who had voted before turning out in those states, Hillary Clinton would easily win both Iowa and New Hampshire. But there are a lot of people telling pollsters that they're going to come out and caucus for the first time in Iowa or vote in a primary for the first time in New Hampshire. And Bernie Sanders tends to be winning those people 2-1, 3-1, that sort of thing. And reaching out to those sort of non-traditional voters through social media has been a key component of his strategy, less so than the TV ads and stuff that generally are the cornerstone of presidential campaigns. So I think we'll have a much better idea by this time next Tuesday if Bernie Sanders pulled off an upset in Iowa. It shows that a lot of those sort of newer techniques really were effective for him. If Hillary Clinton ends up winning by a wider margin, maybe that shows that the traditional stuff is still the best stuff.
Well, it also raises the question about the level of discourse and the dichotomy now. I mean, if you have a guy like Bernie Sanders who is making a surge in the polls, he's the guy with the heady argument about structural reasons for inequality. That's the thing we thought could never possibly track with voters. And then you have Donald Trump, on the other hand, who makes an appeal to something far different in our minds. And I think that's something that dissonance, that discord in the way the rhetoric is playing out on both sides is something that voters are starting to track. Let's listen.
My name is Katie Cardenas from Garner, North Carolina. And I think the big issue right now is discrimination, especially against Muslims and Hispanics. I think that a spirit of fear is being spread in the elections right now to try to win votes and polarize the voters instead of building a unified country.
Steve Green, what do you make of that? I mean, it's certainly working with Trump voters. I think the latest CNN poll has him at 41% of Republican voters. And yet you have Bernie Sanders on the other hand.
Well, I think what you're seeing on both sides is voters who feel they are very frustrated. And we heard that with the earlier call-in, that the system is not working for them, that the system is rigged against the little guy, the big money. So I think Bernie Sanders is very much appealing to people frustrated in that direction. Meanwhile, on the right, you have a lot of people who are very frustrated by immigration and see that they don't have the action that they would like to see being taken from Washington, feel that Washington politicians, the Republican establishment, if you will, is not listening. And so, again, I think Donald Trump is largely speaking to that frustration. And when you're frustrated and feel that nobody's listening to you and nobody's giving you voice, and then somebody gives that voice, whether it's Bernie Sanders or Donald Trump, that engenders a lot of enthusiasm.
Well, that may be what they have in common. But Jarvis Hall, let me ask you, kind of in the history of American politics, speaking to certain anxieties, speaking to certain issues, that might be what the candidates have in common. But the language that these two candidates are using, it feels like they're, in a way, talking to two totally separate audiences with two very different kinds of logic systems, in a way. Have we ever been this far apart in how we talk about an issue?
The more things change, the more they stay the same. And the reason I say that is because really this boils down to a question of, will voters vote their hopes or their fears? Mm. And on the one side, in terms of fears, quite obviously that's the Trump group and many on the Republican side, when they vilify certain groups and, you know, blame the problems that the middle class is having on the other and things of that nature. Whereas more on the Democratic side, it's more an expression of hope. What can we do in order to bring about change? What can we do in order to make things better? It's not saying that your problems are due to somebody else. The other, again, the invading people of color from whatever border, be it the Atlantic Ocean or our southern border. And so one would hope, because it's a question between being an idealist or a realist, but as an idealist, you would hope that we will vote for our hopes as opposed to our fears. So yes, we're more polarized in different ways than we have been before, but at the same time, it's just another version of things that have existed throughout our political history.
But Susan, in a way, we're talking about the same thing. I mean, what Jarvis is saying is, in some ways, an appeal to the irrational on both sides, either hope in something you can't see and isn't here now, or fear of something that you can't see and can't possibly be as bad as it's described. So in a way, I mean, this sort of gets to how much we pay attention to the details and the facts, and to what extent irrational factors like hopes and things we can't see or fears of things we can't see play a part. Would you? I mean, is there anything in that? Anything to that?
Well, Sure. I think you can look at both Trump and Sanders as being, you know, candidates of insurgency. I think the Democrats and the supporters of Bernie Sanders are much more frustrated. And as Nikki Haley said to Donald Trump and all the Republican candidates, as an aside, don't be angry. I would see the Republicans as more angry. They're playing into those fears, that populist fears, that nativism. I don't think these have, I mean, the days of George Wallace, these are not new. But I think the plans that Hillary Clinton, the pragmatic, and maybe some of the other Republicans further down the ticket, Rubio, Bush, those aren't playing as well as the more hopes and fears and philosophical. It's easy to explain. I mean, it's easy to explain. You ask voters in Iowa, all over the country, why you're voting or choosing Donald Trump. And that is because you just have to say he tells it like it is. Things are broken. You don't have to go into any of the nuances of policy. I think it really is the differences are very stark between anger and frustration, but also if you look at people and ask them, are you satisfied with the direction of the country? And Tom, with polling, could address this better than I can. But I think it's about 20% or so that are satisfied with the direction of the country. Fewer still have support or trust Congress to do the right thing. So it's across the board, but it's also being fertilized by Donald Trump and frustration by Bernie Sanders, anger necessarily.
I tell you what, I'll ask Tom about that. We're going to take a break right now, then we'll come back, find out more about that, and take your calls at 877-962-9862. On the state of things, please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. Today, talking about political engagement in North Carolina and looking at what issues are important at our state. We're taking your phone calls at 877-962-9862. If you want to join our conversation, Susan Roberts is with me, a professor of political science at Davidson College. Jarvis Hall is a political science professor at North Carolina Central University. Steve Green teaches political science at NC State. And Tom Jensen is with us he's the director of public policy polling. Tom, let me ask you a question that Susan raised at the end of that last segment, and that is sort of how voters are feeling in general about the way things are going, the direction of the country.
Well, they're certainly in a bad mood, and I think that's driving a lot of what's helping Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders to do so well. But one thing that's really interesting about sort of people's perceptions about the direction we're heading in is, in some cases, they seem to be based a little bit more on sort of political ideology than actual facts. For instance, polling has repeatedly found that Republicans think that the economy has gotten worse under President Obama, and really by any sort of objective measure over the last 7 years, the economy has improved tremendously under President Obama. But you have conservative voters sort of refusing to acknowledge that. And I think it's a reflection of how polarized we've become in the country that people won't even acknowledge that things are getting better when they are clearly getting better because you don't want to give the president credit. And I think you'd probably see a similar situation to that if the roles were reversed. I don't think that Democratic voters would be willing to give a Republican any credit for a sort of uptick in the economy. So sort of underlying all this general unhappiness is the increased level of polarization that makes us sort of unwilling to give anybody credit for anything, even when it is getting better.
Let's go to the phones. Wiley Cash is on the line from Wilmington. Wiley, hi.
Hey, Frank. Great listening to the show. I think the real star of this election, and I haven't heard a lot of people talk about it, but something that I've been really mystified by is this faux rage that's really driving the right, especially you guys talked a lot about Trump, but the previous speaker on the line just mentioned it. But by every significant measurable, we are so much better off than we were in 2008 or 2009. I mean, it's really amazing, especially in terms of immigration and the economy, personal safety, crimes at the lowest level since 1990. But if you watch a Trump rally or, you know, a Christie rally or a Cruz rally, you would never know that. And I'm wondering what is feeding what is truly a manufactured rage. It's a lie. It's a lie about how angry we should be.
Well, let's put that. Susan Roberts, let me start with you.
Well, I think that, some of it is framing and priming. And I think the candidates have framed the issue as one of take America back, make America great again. I'm not sure we can measure the fears. I think in terms of terrorism, that fuels a fear, as Jarvis said, of the other. Are we more vulnerable to terrorism in North Carolina? Maybe if you look at Charlotte as a banking center, but I think people have started to say if it can happen in San Bernardino, it can happen anywhere. So I think that fear, those fears are fairly obvious to many people. But I do think that they're perhaps Trump and others playing on the fears that may not be there. And you have many people that are threatened by the idea of a country in which minorities could be the majority of citizens in the future. I think that's very sad, but I think it's something that you have to consider. And I think that, you know, we look at the numbers about the economy and education. They are better. I don't know that people are bothering some. And, you know, some voters on the Republican side, are they bothering to listen to the facts? They're listening to the rhetoric, which is very, very sad. And I think Trump, all of us would agree that Trump is soundbite proof. He is insult proof. And it is still entertainment. But we're very close to Iowa, and we can see if this is something that's going to last. And I think, you know, I think Trump is going to do well in Iowa, whether he beats Ted Cruz or not. I think he's going to do quite well.
Steve Green, though, isn't there something to, more than just sort of siding with your guy, to the subjective sense that things aren't going that well, that where I'm headed, that my kids' college debt, if I can get them there, is going to leave them saddled with debt for half of their life?
Yeah, no.
My security is not that great.
Absolutely.
I have a job, but it doesn't pay well.
Right. As we talked about before the show, there is more uncertainty than ever for the American middle class. And those fears, those anxieties are real. The ability to look into the future and say, my kid will do better than me, it's not the same as it was a generation ago. There's definitely more uncertainty there, especially if you look at less educated voters. And again, Trump is especially popular among less educated Republican voters. You know, whereas again, a generation ago, you maybe knew there was some sort of factory job or something that could provide a stable line of work. We just don't have those jobs. We have a changing world. We have globalization and immigration. There's a lot of change, a lot of uncertainty in the world, and that's certainly going to raise anxiety. And the right politician can channel anxiety into fear, rage, et cetera.
Well, particularly when the actual source of the problem is so complex. And Jarvis, that gets us to this very difficult analysis. On the one hand, you have to credit Barack Obama with bailing us out of one of the worst economic catastrophes in our nation's history. That happened under 8 years of the previous administration. He got us out of that. You got to give him credit for that. On the other hand, now we listen to Bernie Sanders and say the jobs that are being created in the aftermath of that are not as high paying. The amount of debt that people are taking on is making them insecure. So that's when Bernie Sanders' argument starts making a little more sense. Let's examine these structural inequalities. Does that create a fissure almost within the Democratic Party?
Well, there are some structural problems that too often are pushed to the side. We talk about general economic indicators, unemployment, inflation, but we don't always pay as much attention to rising inequality and why that has taken place, globalization, but the decline of unions, the stagnant minimum wage, and those kinds of things. We're starting to talk about those kinds of things, and in the absence of people like Bernie Sanders, and to some extent, President Obama introducing these kinds of things later on in his administration, we wouldn't be talking about those things now, you know. So I think that I'm happy with the fact that we are talking about structural issues that will get us beyond just looking at whether the unemployment rate is up or down. How much is inequality being addressed? How much is chronic unemployment being addressed? In the absence of Bernie Sanders, and as I said, President Obama, we probably wouldn't be talking about those things.
Let's go back to the phones now. Scott is on the line from Southern Pines. Hello, Scott. Let's try Wynn. Wynn, are you there? Well, having some problems with our phones, but it does, you know, raise questions here in the state of North Carolina about the kinds of issues that were debated fiercely. For instance, the decision by the governor and the legislature not to expand Medicaid. And that's something that affected 500,000 North Carolinians. Is that the kind of thing, and it happened a while ago, or it didn't happen? So how does that work? Let me ask you, Steve, first, as a political issue, 500,000 people without medical care because of a decision by the legislature, does that track as a political issue, and does it endure to 2016?
Well, I mean, you know, among Democrats, they think that's horrible, and they're going to continue to support Democratic candidates. Among Republicans, you know, the Medicaid expansion is part of Obamacare. And, you know, and then furthermore, people who qualify for Medicaid tend to be poorer, down on their luck people, and as a result, less likely to be voters. So in terms of worrying about that particular portion of the electorate, the legislators are not so concerned.
Susan Roberts, let me ask you the same question.
Sure. I think that for the Republicans, you can reduce, the failure of Medicaid expansion to questions of the size and the scope and the reach of the federal government, which I think is a real concern for those on the right. And I think ideology plays a lot with that. These things, as you've pointed out, the uncertainty factor, I think health care and the rising cost of insurance give that sense of uncertainty to everyone, because I think everyone is looking in terms of my children and their health care and my health care and when I get older. I think that the issues of, education, that's one issue that I think North Carolinians, perhaps more than others, have on their minds as well. There's uncertainty, as you point out. Will my children be better off than I was? Where is that, you know, the jaded expression, the American dream? And I think people are they're considering whether or not life will be better for their children.
These kinds of issues play out not necessarily in terms of, there's no vote in the legislature on whether or not your children will have a better future, up or down, right? The General Assembly never takes that into account.
Sure.
But some voters realize that they happen in some of the more mundane and less interesting topics, as Jim Connor points out.
Hi, this is Jim Connor, and I'm speaking to you from Raleigh, North Carolina. The critical issue that I'd like to elevate for consideration is the recent changes in North Carolina tax policy. I see tremendous risks to populations who are faced with critical medical crises, faced with unemployment, and the 85% of North Carolina kids who are educated in public schools with a demoralized and defunded public school system. I think revising the tax policy to benefit an influx of new commercial operations would be brilliant if it worked, but I don't see any signs of it working, and these concern me.
Tom Jensen at Public Policy Polling, what do we know about how voters feel about issues and what's most important to them, and sort of how they track these anxieties, how they actually play out in terms of actual issues that the General Assembly and the governor has to tackle?
Sure. I think the defining issue in the governor's race this year really is going to be public education. I think that Pat McCrory and Republicans in the legislature running for re-election will make the argument that they really have done right by teachers with raising teacher pay, that they've increased funding over the last 2 years, that sort of thing. You'll have Roy Cooper and Democrats arguing very strongly to the contrary, that we're losing all of our best teachers to other states, that we rank in the bottom five states in the country for education funding, those sorts of things. And it's really just going to, I think, come down to a question of which one of these arguments do voters believe more, do they find more compelling? Because I think you're going to have both the Democrats and Republicans saying that public education is very important. Republicans are going to say we've done right by it. Democrats are going to say you've done terrible and you need to put us back in charge to get things back on the right track. There's going to be lots of contradictory facts out there that both sides are going to be throwing out there that voters are going to sort of have to make a sense of one way or the other. But I really do think when we think about our state races this year, that's going to be the issue that rises to the top.
What do you think, Steve Green?
Yeah, I think, sadly, you know, it's hard for voters to make sense of that. And Republicans are going to see the ads that say, oh, we increased, you know, base pay, and they'll pick the very best statistics. And oh, OK, Republicans are good. Democrats will see the statistics that say, you know, 48th, whatever, and teacher pay. And, you know, people will stick with their voting patterns.
Jarvis, in terms of the top, what do you think is the top issue? And then you can also weigh in on how education is going to play into this race if you don't think it's maybe the number one issue.
I agree. At the state level, it almost by definition has to be the number one issue. And the reason I say that is because when we look at the portion of the state budget, which is what the legislature does for much of the time when over in Raleigh, close to 60% of state budget goes to public education. And so they spend a lot of time on it. It hits home more than any other issue. It is the thing that is supposed to be the equalizer. So from a cultural sense, fairness in education is important. But I think when you mix what's going on with education, what I would say the gutting of public education, the shift toward charter schools, support for vouchers, even the diminished support for higher education itself. I think that the issue of fairness also becomes important when you couple that with tax policy, when you make the argument that tax policy is in favor of the wealthy and things of that nature. So if you roll that together and put it in a nice soundbite with fairness as the thing that you remember from that soundbite, I think that that could become a very important issue. It is a very important issue, and that's the kind of thing that could really mobilize those who are a part of what we've been calling the grassroots.
Well, Susan Roberts, I want to ask you the same question, but I want to reframe it a little bit and take a step back. If you take a look at what happened in Wisconsin with regard to teachers and teachers' unions, right, in the election there for governor, that's a reversal, it seems to me, and you can challenge this if you think I'm totally off base. But the idea that suddenly people at the lowest pay rungs, organized teachers, will be the enemy, and that can be a successful campaign. That you can campaign against teachers and win seems to me something new, at least in my lifetime. That was not you couldn't run against teachers and win, and you did in Wisconsin. I wonder if that has any way of translating it to here in North Carolina, or whether that tells us anything nationally about how we're framing issues and understanding these issues.
Well, as in context, North Carolina, unions really don't exist for teachers in North Carolina. If you look at, except for the NEA, I think that what Scott Walker did in Wisconsin was emblematic of a greater assault on government workers. In North Carolina, though, I think, you know, we've talked about education as being eviscerated. One thing that people don't have to have is they don't have to have the numbers in front of them to say, gee, my child doesn't have a teaching assistant anymore. Gee, Mrs. So-and-so or Mr. So-and-so left. And I think they can, you can get a sense at the very visceral level about what's going on in education and in higher education. As we're educators, we look to see that the health of and viability of different campuses at the UNC system, which was one of the hallmarks of North Carolina as a progressive state, unlike any state in the South. I was going to make the point when you talked about real hurriedly about, I'll say, North Carolina may not be that different from all the other states where we're looking at restrictive access to abortion law, restrictive voting rights law, and some of the mentality that you get, some of the political culture from South Carolina, and they've always had poor numbers in terms of teacher pay, are permeating North Carolina as well.
I want to thank all of you for being on our program. Susan Roberts, political science professor at Davidson College. Jarvis Hall teaches political science at North Carolina Central. Steve Green teaches political science at NC State. And Tom Jensen is the director of public policy polling. It's a national polling firm based in Raleigh. Thank you all for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, Charlie Shelton, and Andrew Todd. Robin Copley is our technical director. Brent Wolf is WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.